Thanks, Mark, for your wonderful presentations. And now I'm going to invite Professor Ivan Fraser. And he is holding a very prestigious Canada Research Chair in the Department of Geography, University of Guelph. And he received a PhD and postdoc from British Columbia. And already he worked in the University of Leeds for a long time, from 2003 to 2010. And Professor Fraser, the floor is yours.
So I have a stopwatch, 10 minutes. It's all I get, starting now. As the chairs of the session have announced, the purpose of this particular panel is to explore how we can manage the political fallout of food crisis. And in my opinion, the only real meaningful way of doing that is to better unpack the links between food prices and political volatility. And so to explore this point, I'd like to pick up on points that Mark, wherever Mark just disappeared to, and Robert, there we go, thank you, just made. And for instance, if you do a quick review of the sort of the commentary on the food crisis the last few years, you get a very simplistic picture of what the links between food prices and food protests are. Dominique Strauss-Kahn, former IMF head, saying, as we know, those kind of questions about food prices, sometimes end in war. An American journalist commenting on the riots in Cameroon in 2008, a hungry man is an angry man. Commentator on the Tunisian riots in 2010-11, when food prices rise and people have nothing to lose, they lose it. And Canada's own Jeff Rubin, author of The End of Growth, writing, nothing sends a person into the streets quite like an empty stomach. This is obviously exploring or presenting a causal relationship between expensive food and political protest. And the obvious management implications of this are bring food prices down. But the data doesn't suggest that this is quite so simple. If you look at a distribution map of where food prices have occurred, we have Gwynne Dyer, the war journalist, giving us this distribution, where our eyes are attracted to those countries in red, where between 2008 and 11, food riots occurred. Here we have a map of the distribution of poverty, and our eyes should be attracted to the red and the brown countries, where hunger is most acute. And then we look at the correlation between them. And even this crude correlation, or crude visual analysis, suggests that there are hungry places, poor places, that don't have riots, and relatively well-off places that do. So this has got me thinking, and my research team thinking, well, what are the causes between a food price change and a hunger and political unrest? So I jumped at the opportunity a few years ago to do some interviews with people from Cameroon who had witnessed the food riots in Cameroon in 2008. And I asked them, first of all, what caused the riots? And secondly, I asked them, how does one manage this sort of situation? And I was expecting to get comments much like the quotes I opened with, but I didn't. For instance, one commentator said to me, the food riots were caused because a group of merchants were taking advantage of everyone. The merchants are cutthroat business guys who don't give a damn about people. The implications, according to this speaker, was that the government should intervene, should confiscate the merchants' warehouses and distribute the food to the poor. And indeed, that's to a large extent what the Cameroonian government did, and the food riots came down. Now, one of the things that struck me as interesting about this particular quote is that it echoes a line of reasoning that goes back in history. If we go to 1917, there was a period of very serious food price inflation in New York City. And Murray Ganz, a union organizer pictured here, organized a group of housewives from New York to boycott the grocers of New York City. And the standoff between the grocers and the housewives grew in tension over a number of weeks. And it culminated in a food fight that raged up and down the streets of Manhattan. Carts were overturned, vendors pelted with rotting cabbage. The housewives climaxed their protest by storming the restaurant of the Waldorf Astoria Hotel, a very dramatic moment in New York's history. A couple of years later, Mary Ganz reflected on this and wrote this quote. In the protest, surely 1,000 women were in that long, mad struggle, enduring wives and mothers who had resolved to bear the oppression of the profiteer no longer. And what's interesting to me about both of these quotes and both of these comments is there's nothing to do with hunger or deprivation in this. It's moral outrage against the unfairness of a trading system, anger directed at merchants, that acts as the spark that lights the fire. We can even go back further in history. This is an Elizabethan document, and I'd like you to look at the top half, where you see three figures. And the figure in the middle of this image is a farmer who's being beaten by a magistrate standing on his left. The reason the farmer is being beaten is he's broken a law. A law that picks up on the same logic as Mary Gans and the protesters in Cameroon. The law was called the Assize of Bread. And it was a law that said farmers and bakers had to sell first to the poor and then to the rich. They had to sell at the same price, and they were not allowed to stockpile food in the hopes of a higher price. This was a piece of legislation designed to prevent food protests. It was a piece of legislation that understood that food wasn't just any traded commodity in the minds of people who were eating. This farmer has broken the law. You see the figure on the right. It's another magistrate that's inspected the farmer's warehouse, discovered the farmer has held food back from the market, and therefore broken the law. So according to these three examples, the way of managing a food political volatility, is through government intervention to prevent the food trade from happening, to make sure that the poor had access to food and felt that they had an equitable say in their distribution. But of course, this is an extremely expensive way of running a food system. It's very inefficient. It stifles the entrepreneurial spirits of farmers. It prevents bakers from thinking of ingenious ways to make new loaves of bread and be more efficient. So we can roll the clock back to 2008 and inspect the causes of a food riot from a different angle, that of a senior policymaker or the World Bank, which wholly objects to the idea of governments intervening in the markets and think that this is the problem, not the solution. So Robert Zoellick, former president of the World Bank, reflecting on the causes of the food price crisis in 2008, said this: defensive trade policies contributed very substantially to increases in world prices of staple crops in the 2008 crisis. This is exactly the opposite logic as what I was just telling you about. It's also a piece of logic that is also at the head of a long intellectual tradition. Let's go back to a previous food crisis, in the 1870s, in the food crisis in India that triggered a serious famine. The British colonial authority was accused of not doing enough, and Sir Evelyn Baring, then England's finance minister, answered the charge and said this: "Any policy to mitigate the effects of famine serve but to enhance the evils resulting from overpopulation." Let's unpack this for a second, because I think this reveals two things. First of all, it reveals the cold, calculating logic of laissez-faire economics. And second, it is essentially the same argument as Robert Zoellick made in the quote that I just used. Any policy to mitigate a famine just makes matters worse, according to Sir Evelyn Baring. And of course, we hear this echoed back even further in history. Adam Smith, the granddaddy of the laissez-faire economic theory, author of The Wealth of Nations, writing on famines in the 17th century, said, "Famines are caused by the violence of governments attempting by improper means to remedy the inconveniences of a dearth." The language is antiquated, but the message is the same. Famines are caused by government policy meddling in the food trade. Far more efficient, to quote another 17th century economist, to let food or grain flow like water and it too shall find its level. Far better to have the market create incentives for farmers to create productivity, for bakers and merchants to develop the trade infrastructure. Far more efficient and productive. So what I'd have you take from this debate is that when we look at the causes, or the debates over the causes of the links between a food price rise and a political volatility, what we see are two broad intellectual traditions: a left-wing tradition, which I've put on the left, and I've colored in sort of liberal red, and a right-wing tradition on the right, which I've sort of colored Tory blue. And what I'd have you note is that we've got a standoff between the authors of The Assize of Bread and Adam Smith that we then reflect again down through the history between Mary Gans and Sir Evelyn Baring and see manifest in the last few years between the debates between the protesters in Cameroon and the World Bank. And on the right-hand side, we've got an assumption that food is best managed as part of a commercial economy where production and distribution are controlled by the market, and this creates an efficient and productive system. On the left, we have an assumption that food is best managed as part of a moral economy, where production and distribution are controlled by ethics, justice, and tradition, and put welfare of the individual at the heart of the policy. I would hypothesize, as I'm working my head through these issues, that one of the reasons that the food price crisis hit in 2008 was that people on the left were reacting to the imposition of the assumptions on the right. creating the situation where people who thought they had a moral entitlement to food felt that that moral entitlement was being taken away and turned into a commercial commodity. And that was one of the causes that lit that moral anger that propelled people into the streets. It's a different argument than hunger, but it's still very important. So what are the implications of this? On my last slide, as Paul waves the one-minute warning. Policymakers today tend to be dominated, I believe, by people who have accepted the assumptions of the market economy. But while this may result in an economically rational and highly efficient system, these same policymakers must be mindful of these more psychological causes of food riots. If policymakers simply embrace the efficiency of the market, public feelings of injustice at the imposition of the market into something they consider part of the moral economy may trigger more political volatility than expensive food simply does on its own. Thank you very much.